Good afternoon and welcome to Bingham Presents 2014, Current Issues in Broker-Dealer Enforcement, broadcast live from Bingham McCutcheon's offices in New York and online at www.sechistorical.org. I am Eric Reuter, lecturer in law at Boston University School of Law and moderator for today's program. Since its debut in 2009, the Bingham Presents series has examined current, cutting-edge issues in financial regulation of interest to the legal profession. The series is made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon and the SEC Historical Society. With lawyers and offices on three continents, anchored by major commitments in the world's key financial centers, Bingham offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry. Bingham lawyers understand how capital markets fit together, how taxes shape global financial policy, how regulations compete and conflict, how litigation integrates with business objectives, and how cross-border legal strategies must coordinate. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. I am a member of the Society's Board of Trustees and serve on the Museum Committee, advising on the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Past Bingham Presents programs have examined such issues as asset management, criminal enforcement of securities laws, harmonization of the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers, and enforcement after the Dodd-Frank Act. All of the previous Bingham Presents broadcasts are available in both audio and edited transcript formats in the Bingham Presents section under programs in the virtual museum and archive. I encourage you to check them out at the end of this broadcast. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of Bingham for this series. This evening, we will be examining current issues in broker-dealer enforcement. And joining with me are Timothy Burke, co-chair of Bingham's Financial Institutions Regulatory Enforcement and Litigation Group, and practice group leader of the firm's broker-dealer regulatory practice. Tim is also a member of the SEC Historical Society's Board of Advisors. Andrew Cerisny, director of the SEC Division of Enforcement, is here. Prior to his SEC appointment, Andrew served as assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, where he was a deputy chief appellate attorney and a member of the Securities and Commodities Fraud Task Force and the Major Crimes Unit. Eric Grossman, chief legal officer of Morgan Stanley, is here. Eric joined Morgan Stanley in 2006 and has served as global head of litigation and general counsel of the Americas before his 2012 appointment as chief legal officer. Joaquin Jack Cena, Associate General Counsel, Bank of America. Jack leads Bank of America's Regulatory Inquiries Group and previously served as Assistant Chief Litigation Counsel in the SEC Division of Enforcement. Welcome all. I have had the privilege of working with the presenters to prepare today's discussion and would like to begin with a question for Andrew, and it's a very broad question, one that will not come as a surprise to anyone, and that is, Andrew, could you give us all an overview of the enforcement strategies and priorities at the SEC as they apply to broker-dealer litigation and enforcement? And in particular, we've heard some discussion of the broken windows philosophy and strategy affecting the SEC's approach. How does this work in the broker-dealer context?
Sure. Let me start with, thanks very much for having me here today. Let me just start with my usual disclaimer, which has become second nature to me. I think whenever I speak to anybody, even outside of panels, I say this first, which is that the views expressed in my own do not necessarily reflect the views of the commissioner's staff. And I'm pleased to be here today. Let me sort of address the question and then maybe go a little broader on you and maybe anticipate what probably is your next question. Because I don't want it to be, I don't want the sort of impression to be left that broken windows is our broker-dealer strategy. But I'll address the broken windows issue, and then I'll speak more broadly. I mean, I think, you know, a lot has been made of the broken window strategy, but I think what we're really trying to do here is really focus on areas that we see as lacking in compliance or focus over the recent past and recent history. And the way that we've been doing that, I think, is through streamlined investigations as well as streamlined settlement approaches to cases. And so, and the idea here is to use big data that's now available to us and other resources now available to us that maybe haven't been available to us in the past, use tools that allow us to parse through that data in ways that are very efficient and that allow us to sort of find violations, and then approach the other side maybe through a questionnaire or some other letter asking them for information about what we see as a potential violation, asking them if there's any explanation. And then if there is a violation that we have found, talking to them about some potential settlement in a streamlined way. So what we typically do is we have a matrix of how we would settle the case in a settled context. And often that's a more favorable a resolution than if we were to litigate it. And so what this has allowed us to do, I think, is to really target violations that haven't received much attention before, but do so without taking up many resources and allowing us to continue what I think is obviously our broader strategy of addressing other types of violations. And so we've done this now in a couple of areas, the Rule 105 cases, which we brought last year, which involved 23 firms that settled with us, and those are firms or individuals who traded in securities in advance of and shorted securities in advance of public offerings, within five days of the public offerings. Those are strict liability violations. We were able to bring those very quickly, again with minimal resources. Just this past week, we announced 34 cases. Involving reporting violations under Section 16A and 13D and G. And again, in that situation, we were able to expend minimal resources and obtain what we think are significant settlements, but also, more importantly, send a message to the marketplace about the importance of focusing on these areas. I suspect from the reaction to these cases that folks are much more focused on these areas than they were before we brought these cases, and that's exactly the reaction that we would like. I've also heard, you know, kind of the sense that, well, is everything going to be turned into an enforcement violation now? The answer is no. We still have, you know, OC is still out there examining firms, still issuing deficiency letters in appropriate circumstances and the like. But I do think these are areas that we think have not received sufficient attention, and the idea is to try to increase focus on them. We will have more of these areas coming down the pike. There's a number of initiatives like this that are in process, some of which impact broker-dealers. And so I think you'll be seeing more of this as time goes. But I think the big message on these cases is we think these are areas that need focus and increased focus and compliance, but it's not going to distract us from our broader mission of protecting investors by punishing misconduct more broadly. So that's an answer to the broken windows.
Yeah, Andrew, if I could just ask, sir, with respect to the broken windows campaign that the SEC appears to have, which for those of you who get your financial news from the Wall Street, from the New York Post, you would have seen the article that featured the broken windows enforcement policy that Andrew just described. But in the wake of the Madoff and Stanford Ponzi scheme scandals, the SEC was subject to some criticism about focusing too much energy going after low priority cases, easy to bring cases, easy to win, easy to obtain settlements. And what's the current view with respect to that criticism in terms of the dedication of resources it takes to bring cases like this and the potential that maybe you're missing other more important matters?
Yeah, I don't think our focus on these areas has taken us away from our broader focus on issues like Ponzi schemes and other large-scale frauds. I think we have been as aggressive as we can be in that area and will continue to be. I think all you have to do is look at some of the cases we brought recently where I think we have been aggressive and we have brought, and you'll see, I think, in the coming weeks and months that I think you'll see even more of that. So I don't think that's any issue. And then in terms of, like, is this taking away from our resolve to continue to pursue those cases, one of the sort of striking statistics that I've seen this year is we've had almost double as many trials this year as in past years. I think we're up to 31 or 32 versus 16 or 17 last year. And we've actually had five times as many jury trials, which is a pretty, now, I don't suspect next year we'll have those kinds of numbers, and I think it ebbs and flows, and it just so happened that's what happened this year. But what it does show is that we're willing to take these cases all the way, and willing to stick to it and be aggressive about it. And people ask me, why is it that we're seeing that increase in trials? And I actually attribute it to our aggressiveness, both in terms of bringing the cases, but also in terms of the remedies we're seeking. I think whereas in the past we might have settled for lesser money or lesser bars, now we're insisting on that, and that sometimes means we're going to have to go to trial, and that's fine, and we're willing to do that. I think that answers your question.
Big data sounds ominous. It starts with big, like Big Brother, but we know that the SEC is not that kind of agency. But how do you decide how you're going to sync what you look at to the enforcement priorities? Because one could look at this from a distance and say, well, how do you process data? Let's figure out how to process it and then see what violations become apparent. Or do you first say, here are our substantive areas of priority. Now let's figure out how we can work with the data to serve the priorities that we've already identified in enforcement.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. Obviously, data just out there is not going to help you advance your cause. You need to be looking for patterns in that data. You need to be looking for how that data reveals misconduct. So, I think it is quite transformative. The last 5 to 10 years, the increase in data available, and then also the increase in the tools that allow you to review that data. And just to mention a couple of areas where this has become very important, insider trading. For a long time, and they still do it, FINRA has been excellent in terms of processing referrals to us, looking for a suspicious activity, and they've done a great job with it and continue to do it on a daily basis. But what we're doing now is actually doing our own analysis of the data and finding patterns in terms of traders that trade in unison. And that allows us to work backwards and then find the source for that information. And we have a bunch of investigations in process that really have been created as a result of that. In some cases, the investigations have really blossomed through that kind of data. And so that's been a very helpful. There's other ways that the data has been very helpful. For example, I'm talking a little bit about the broker-dealer task force, but there's now an ability to sort of look at firm trading on a much broader basis. OC, for example, now when they go in for an exam, they actually ask for the trade blotter for the last 3 or 4 years, whereas they in the past might have asked for a week or a month. And now when they get that trade data, they're able to really parse it and look for patterns of activity that are problematic, cherry picking, front running, et cetera. And so it really sort of opens up a whole new world for us. So, what we've done in the enforcement division is we are leveraging, obviously, the other aspects of the agency that have been using data, but we're also trying to create, we've created a group called Center for Risk and Quantitative Analytics, which is meant to coordinate this sort of data analysis. That's within the Division of Enforcement. Laurie Walsh is the head of that group. And the idea there is we have both quant folks and economists and others who are familiar with the data, excluding lawyers who have had investigative experience. And they can, if there's a person, say, in Denver office who has an idea that there's this stash of data out there that might show patterns, they can call Circa and say to Circa, help us develop a tool that would allow us to parse through this data and find the patterns that we're looking for. Obviously, to sort of where you started off, you need to have an idea about what I'm looking for in order to actually be directional about that. But I think it is transformative. And the other thing it's doing is it's allowing us to get through the investigations much more quickly. So whereas before you got hard copies of phone records or bank account records, and you needed to spend months looking through those and looking for the patterns, now you can just input it all into a program and, it I don't want to say spits out because that makes it sound so easy, but it really processes the data in a way that allows you to see the patterns and to see the issues much more quickly. It takes minutes what previously would have taken you months. So it's very exciting stuff.
Well, part of this, if you could take us inside the SEC, I don't know how many of you have looked at an organizational chart. There seem to be more and more announcements about organizational restructurings, but you have the Office of Economic and Risk Analysis, you have certainly OC, you have the Division of Trading and Markets. It seems like an embarrassment of riches here, resources at the SEC that can be trained on, among other things, broker-dealers. Doesn't it become more complicated in some ways to navigate these different offices in connection with any particular enforcement program, including a broker-dealer enforcement program?
So, I mean, let me say this. I mean, one of the things that has struck me in my time at the SEC is sort of the amazing amount of expertise that you have in the building. I mean, you just mentioned a whole bunch of areas that at least touch on the broker-dealer realm. And there's no question that those are critical partners for us as we go forward. And I would add FINRA to that list, as well as some other external partners like state regulators and the like. And, you know, I think you're right. It is a challenge to try to know where to go and know how to navigate it. At the same time, it provides us with just tremendous resources and ability. I mean, you know, for example, I'll just take one example. So in the enforcement division, we have several different areas in which you're going to have broker-dealer-related cases. We have the market abuse unit, which is focused on trading activities of broker-dealers, things like 15C3-5, the market access rule, reg show, sort of trading abuses, manipulative abuses. We have the complex financial instruments unit, which is focused on, you know, on products, complicated products, the marketing sale, disclosures relating to those, as well as valuation, other issues relating to complex products like CMBS, like structured notes, and other types of complex products. We have the Muni unit, which is focused on municipal securities and some fixed income from the municipal market, and very focused on those. And then you have other parts of the division, which are what we call the core, which are non-unit parts, which are very focused on broker-dealer cases, often through referrals that they get from OC in the particular region. So, for example, if the New York OC does an exam of broker-dealers and finds an issue, they might refer that over to the New York office, and that'll be handled by the enforcement division in New York. So we have all of these different parts of the division that are focused on broker-dealer issues, and I think it seems a little decentralized, but what I see strength in the kind of the broad breadth. We have the units that are focused on particular areas, but also division core unit core division folks who are focused on other areas, and I think it ends up working. One of the things that we've done in this past year to try to increase national focus on broker-dealer issues and centralize some of this expertise and knowledge is created a broker-dealer task force. You know, and that sort of originated from, we've had in the past 4 years, we had the asset management unit, which was a unit that we created 4 years ago amongst the five specialized units. And that unit created a great relationship with the OC asset management, so the investment company, investment advisor side of OC. And they have a great partnership. They work together on initiatives. They share ideas. They meet quite often. We didn't have a similar group on the broker-dealer side. We obviously had in the various regions broker-dealer examiners dealing with enforcement lawyers, but we didn't have anybody thinking about these issues on a national level and thinking about national initiatives and also centralizing the expertise. And so we created this task force. And what it is it's a couple of senior officers, Andy Calamari and Tony Cheon, who are the chairs of it. But it also is staffed by folks from each of the regions so that we can then roll out throughout the division initiatives. And, you know, this task force is focused, at least in the first instance, they've decided to focus on a couple of important areas, including AML obligations and churning. But they're looking at other areas and working in conjunction with OC to try to determine other areas of initiative. So, you know, I think what we're trying to do, as you suggest, is bring some centralization, but also have, you know, multiple aspects of the division focused on this.
I think I'd like to turn to Eric. Thank you. And to Jack. We've heard a great deal about how robust the enforcement division's enforcement program is with regard to broker-dealers. I take it then that the SEC won't be looking for yet more funding to hire yet more people to work in the broker.
Correct that.
Okay. But Jack, and let me ask Jack first, and then if Eric could weigh in. How has this affected how you go about your respective jobs, knowing the role that big data is playing now, and knowing how many eyes and how many computer servers are focused on the broker-dealer activities? Does it pose additional complexities for how you administer internally your own programs?
Well, from my perspective, not a lot has changed in terms of the feeling that we have a lot of eyes on us, right? That's always been a given. I think with respect to some of the requests that we see for more data, more information, not just trading data and such, but even, you know, emails and things like that. My understanding is the SEC over the last several years has really geared up its resources to churn through all of this stuff. That always imposes a cost on us as more and more stuff is asked for. We're often wondering, what are they going to do with all of this? Now I have a little bit more of insight. But there's a heavy cost on the firms in terms of producing this stuff and trying to get ahead of it, right? We're producing a lot more data, a lot more information. We need to understand what's there as we're producing it, or hopefully before we produce it, to understand whether we've got a problem that needs to be fixed that we haven't already seen.
And Eric, would you?
He nailed it.
Yes. Does that does that mean that everything now is in a faster pace for you because of the enhanced use of technology at the SEC? Do you have as much time to do the sorts of deliberations and planning and coordination? Or do you feel like you've lost some ability on your end because the SEC is so much more efficient these days?
Get carried away.
I'm being devil's advocate here.
I feel like it's always been a challenge, right, to keep up with the demands that the staff makes in terms of an investigation. I can't draw a line and say, since they acquired this technology or since they reorganized in this way, all of a sudden things have changed for us. It's always a challenge. Sitting back, my impression is that I've seen cases move along faster. I've seen more information sought, but there's still those cases that linger on for years and years, and you wonder, why don't they just drop it? There really must not be a case there. They've gotten too attached to their case or their view. Overall, yeah, I think there's just a higher demand for information, and there's more of a challenge for us to keep up with it.
So one of the things that occurs to me, Andrew, and I'll turn it back to you, is if the SEC has spent all this money and devoted all these resources to coming up with the technology that allows you to look at various trading data in a way that you guys find of interest, is that technology something that you'd be willing to share with the industry? Because there's a lot of effort that goes into trying to monitor these exact same sort of behaviors on the industry side. Is that something that you foresee there could be some ability to partner?
I would say that that's probably more of a question for somebody like Drew Bowden of OC. I think Drew has said publicly that, and he's been very vocal about the technology that the OC side has developed, and I think sort of more public about what it consists of and how it works and that kind of thing. On the enforcement side, we still have an interest in making sure that the folks who are out there engaging in misconduct don't know exactly what we're looking for and how we're looking at it, and so that shapes kind of what we're willing to share. For example, I don't really want to share the kind of technology that we have on the insider trading side, since that would allow people to tailor their activities to avoid that. So that's one example. But,
you do want to achieve a deterrent effect as well, so people know that you have these mm-hmm. enhanced capabilities to detect insider trading. Well, you don't need to share your programming and your algorithms. Just getting that message across, I would think, would be a good thing for everyone.
Oh, and I agree. And I think we've been trying to do that some. In some of the cases we brought, we have talked a little bit about how we've made that case. Sometimes, you're a little bit constrained in doing that just because you don't want there to be, again, sort of a record of how you did that. But we've been trying to do that. I think we will do that in the future, is to sort of point out when it is that we've made, you know, for example, the 16A initiative, we talked about quantitative analytics and the use of quantitative analytics to identify the violations. I think you'll see that in some of the other ones we're going to be doing.
Great. Well, thank you. I'd like now to turn to Tim. Probably in this segment, focusing from the standpoint of the counsel for broker-dealer firms and for individuals. Tim, let me start by asking, what is new? What is the challenge these days regarding collateral consequences of enforcement sanctions and proceedings and questions dealing with issues of waiver when you're representing broker-dealers and individuals?
So there's really two key areas that I wanted to tee up for discussion in this sense. And one is the issue around requesting waivers so that collateral consequences do not happen, or that you preserve important things that need to be preserved from an issuer's point of view. And secondly, the SEC enforcement staff's views with respect to requiring that respondents or defendants admit liability or guilt. With respect to the first issue, as many of you know, and let's assume for a moment that we're in one of those situations that's not the 36 cases that you're trying in front of juries, but it's a case that you're actually trying to settle. And there's a lot of dialogue and discourse that goes back and forth with the enforcement staff to reach the settlement that the staff says it would recommend to the commission. And then after the settlement is reached, there's often a process of having to seek waivers. And as I think most folks are aware, one of the waivers that many issuers seek is known as a WKSI waiver, or a well-known seasoned issuer waiver, which allows public companies to issue securities pursuant to shelf registrations. It allows you to test the waters and have communications that are a little bit more flexible. It allows you to use things like free-riding prospectuses, and it allows, frankly, an easy and quick access to capital markets, which most issuers want to preserve. In recent months, there's been a lot of challenges to the use of WKSI waivers or the granting of WKSI waivers, including a rare dissenting opinion that Commissioner Kara Stein issued in the RBS LIBOR case. That then fueled some commentary from Congress, where Senator Brown from Ohio and Congressman Lynch from Massachusetts have been fairly openly critical about the SEC's policy of treating certain issuers differently. In fact, the phrase that's been used is issuers that are too big to ban or too big to bar. Andrew, I'm curious, in terms of the enforcement staff's reaction to issues that might result in a major institution not being able to obtain a waiver because of the way in which the settlement is structured. For example, if it includes a request for cease and desist or a violation of a scienter-based statute, is that something that comes into play as you're negotiating with counsel for the other side in terms of what the allegations of violations are going to be in the settlement document?
Yeah, so what I would say on that is the following. I mean, we're pretty careful not to negotiate the waivers. The waivers are really, for the most part, not issues for the enforcement division. They're handled by the other divisions, Division of Corporation Finance, and in the case of 9A waivers under the Investment Company Act, by the Division of Investment Management. And so we don't get involved in negotiating them. It's not part of the dialogue. Obviously, parties need and try to get those in connection with enforcement cases, but we don't get involved in the, you know, in the dialogue back and forth with the corporate Division of Corporation Finance or IM. And so, you know, we don't, I would say, that they have no impact on the charges that we charge. We're pretty careful to charge the charges we think are appropriate and not let the waivers impact that. And it's also important that parties understand that we won't tie resolutions to the resolution of a waiver. It's not, again, it's not something that's part, because if we do that, we start having negotiations on it. It's not something we're going to negotiate. Having said that, on the, you know, the WKSI waivers, you know, there was a revised statement put out by the Division of Corporation Finance earlier this year, which outlined the policies, the approach that Division of Corporation Finance is going to take to WKSI waivers going forward. That revised policy statement, I think, provides good guidance on the situations that the Division of Corporation Finance, how they view it. I think it reflects how the commission views it generally, even though it's a statement by the Division of Corporation Finance. And I think it's tied mostly to, at least in the WKSI waivers, whether the conduct raises questions about the disclosure practices of the underlying issuer, or whether the conduct raises a question about the integrity of the issuer such that there's a question about reliance on the disclosure practices of the issuer. So, and that's sort of the fundamental question, I think, at issue. And so that remains the question in connection with WKSI waivers. The last thing I'll say is, and I think Mary Jo has made this clear in prior statements she's made on this issue, is that from our perspective, the waivers are not remedies. They're not enforcement remedies. They're not related to they're not remedies that get imposed as part of penalties for the enforcement action. Instead, from our perspective, they are consequences, disqualifications that flow from the enforcement actions, and so they shouldn't be viewed as penalties or additional remedies. They should be viewed as whether those consequences are appropriate given the conduct.
Well, it would seem to me that if one of the consequences of a settlement or a consent decree is that you can no longer issue private placements, that would have to be something that the firm would need to take into consideration before it reaches a settlement with your staff. And maybe I could toss it to Jack or Eric. Are those sort of business ramification decisions being made much earlier in the process, where you need to think about what the potential waiver risks might be before you agree to the consent?
Well, the truth is, this is, it's a relatively new phenomenon. So the working assumption since I've been practicing law is that you'd get these as a matter of course, unless you were, had engaged in conduct where it would not be justified. I think that the change is that there is certainly in the dissent, there is a creeping sense, given the sort of more aggressive posture towards financial institutions and broker-dealers, which is what we're talking about right now, that the old rules are new rules. And so I think for the next financial institution, look, sometimes you have no choice. Like, okay, they're right, they got us, we can't litigate this case, we'll just have to take our medicine, and we'll get it or not get it, and that's, that's fine, but we need to get this case behind us. I think this issue will be tested the next time a financial institution broker-dealer says, you know what, look, we have a difference of opinion, which we have all the time, right, with our regulators. They think this is really bad. We don't think we did anything wrong, but in the interest of, of peace and getting this behind us, we're going to resolve this case. Those are the kinds of cases where you wouldn't have had this discussion before. If you have to have this concern, which based on what Andrew said, can't be answered in advance of making the decision to go to the commission with a proposed settlement, I think it's going to be problematic for those cases that, as I said, are the ones that you'd like to settle, not because you agree, but because it's the right thing to do to get it behind you. So I think that's the change. And look, there's a lot of things whether or not you're going to be asked to give an admission, whether or not you're going to, you're going to have to make some sort of statement of liability. Look, we wrestled always with this question before, the chicken and egg of whether an individual is going to get charged or not. And I think one of the good things that happened and I really think this is a good thing that happened over the years, is you really, whereas over the years that issue was linked. So my first 10 years of practice, it was not unusual for a financial institution to say, look, we'll settle this case, but only if the individuals go. Obviously, we don't have those conversations anymore. You make your advocate. But so the separation of those issues was good, and I think now there's a clarity and understanding across the board. Now, I think there are problems now that have flowed from that. I think that the SEC on occasion uses the threat of individuals, knowing that the financial institutions can't have a conversation about it, to extract settlements that they otherwise would, and they put individuals on occasion in peril, mm-hmm. unfairly, when they have no intention of bringing a case, very unlikely to bring a case, but they can get the financial institution to the table as a consequence of that. I digress. I just think that
don't interpret my silence as a
this is all new. This is new stuff. This is this is new stuff, and and the fact that Congress cares about this at all is new stuff.
Yep.
That Andrew's going to be called up on the Hill, or Mary Jo's going to be called up on the Hill to explain what they've done in a particular case to, some lunatic senator, is that's new stuff. And so we're all adapting to that.
I agree with all that. I also agree with what Andrew said. I mean, look, I think what he put forth is a very pure, substantive explanation of how the waiver process should work. and how it has worked probably in the past. However, it's in a state of flux right now. The process has changed. A lot of questions have been raised. This has become a real issue from this side, right? Because the business wants predictability. They want to know what's happening. You settle a case, right, to have finality and some sort of predictability and closure. When you open it up with things like, you know, you can't be sure if you're going to get a waiver, and there are a number of other collateral consequences for which you need waivers besides WKSI, right? But if you open it up to a lot of uncertainty, the business has a lot of concerns, right? And it used to be that, yes, you would automatically apply for every waiver that was out there, right? And you could have sort of an advance notice as to whether you're going to get it. Now, you actually have to do some often it's not easy, but a lot of work to determine whether you actually need that waiver or not. If not, if you can't just demonstrate it, you cannot apply for it, and hopefully you won't need it down the road.
So what kinds of informal dialogue can you have with, say, a Corp Fin as you're dealing with enforcement as well? Are you able to have some dialogue? Does that narrow the areas of uncertainty?
Well, it does to a certain degree, right? There's a lot of back and forth with the divisions, right, in terms of questions they have. They're anticipating commissioners' questions. I assume they're talking to the commissioner's staff and getting questions back and forth. So it now appears to be a much longer process before you go in. But still, what has changed now is, you know, when they have, and I guess they still formally have delegated authority, but the commission in some cases, I don't know if it will be in all going forward, has pulled back some of that authority. So what I'm hearing, to some degree, they can't give you any indication, because ultimately it's going to the commission for the commission to decide. And that's, you know, you send in your final letter and you wait for that and hope that there isn't a political debate that we've sort of seen before. At the end of the game.
Why can't you just have a contingency or a condition to your settlement offer that says, here are the terms in which we're prepared to settle, and by the way, we need... Well,
Andrew just explained that.
They won't do that.
we can't be in that business. The problem is that draws the enforcement division.
No, you're not part of it.
Well,
but
it has to be us. It's going to
the commissioners.
If you're making your settlement offer contingent on the waivers, then you're drawing us into that process, and then it becomes a settlement term. And we don't want this to become, and it shouldn't become, a term by which we negotiate. If that were to happen, it would draw us into the process in a way that I think
wouldn't be appropriate. But I take it you're agnostic on these.
If you get it,
you get it. And the other divisions will weigh in. We'll do our job.
What was my initial disclaimer?
So why can't they just deal with the commissioners on that issue that enforcement itself says we're agnostic on?
Well, I think you can always get guidance, and I think you still can, as to what the other divisions will recommend. I think what you're suggesting is you're not sure whether that recommendation will carry the day, but you can get a recommendation. And I think it's certainly true to a large extent that most recommendations get accepted, but you know, obviously, as you suggest, this is an area of some additional focus.
So another important issue around the settlement discussion is whether or not the staff is going to insist in certain cases on an admission of some liability or guilt. And about a year ago, Chair White came out with her statement that the commission would, in certain cases, be seeking admissions from the settling party. And that was perhaps fueled by Judge Rakoff's decision in the Citigroup case, I'm just guessing, where he was highly critical of the SEC consenting with Citigroup to a settlement that did not include any admissions, and as he put it quite colorfully, that he could not determine whether or not the requested injunction was in the public interest without, quote, cold, hard, solid facts established by either admissions or trials. 2 months ago, the Second Circuit reversed Judge Rakoff and said that trials are about truth, but consent decrees are about pragmatism. And in the wake of that Second Circuit decision, which I guess recognized that the SEC does have the discretion to enter consent orders without insisting upon an admission, what sort of cases should we expect to see the Enforcement Division nevertheless continue to seek an admission from a settling party?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I just, on the Second Circuit decision, I think You know, our perspective on the Second Circuit decision was that it was, I mean, obviously we agreed with it. You know, what it essentially says is it's within our discretion to decide whether or not we're going to seek admissions or not. And I think judicial review of settlements is quite limited. And that's, I think, consistent with what our view of the law should be. And I think it doesn't change the approach that we announced well before the decision, which is to demand admissions in particular cases. And we've done that in the last year. We're now in double digits in terms of the numbers of admissions that we have. I think I've stopped counting, so I don't know exactly what the number is right now, but it's in double digits. And, you know, I think that's a positive thing. I think when we first came out with this policy, there was a lot of talk about you're not going to be able to get it in particular cases, and it's going to be impossible for you, and people are going to litigate. And I think, you know, those, you know, kind of predictions have been shown to be incorrect. Doesn't mean there won't be cases where people will litigate where we demand admissions, and we understand that. But I think we have, you know, asked for it in the right cases where it increases accountability and acceptance of responsibility and where it's an important facet of the case. You know, I would say that initially when we came out with the policy, we announced certain situations where we would demand it. Things like, for example, harm to large numbers of investors, egregious conduct, obstruction of the investigation, significant risk to the markets, where the conduct was such that admissions would send a message to investors so that they know and understand unambiguous facts regarding the conduct of the defendant, and also cases where we thought it would enhance the message of the case, unambiguous facts would enhance the message of the case. Those remains the factors that we will consider. I will admit that it's not exactly. that it's not, that in certain cases that it is a little bit of eye of the beholder, but we make lots of judgments in cases, and this is just one of the additional judgments that we make. And I think, you know, the last year has sort of borne out that it will work, and that it's an important additional tool in our arsenal, I think. And I think it has paid dividends in terms of the way in which it has sent the right message in the cases where we've asked for them. And I think that will continue.
Is there anything particular about broker-dealers as opposed to public issuers that might impact any of those factors that you mentioned, Andrew? I don't know how many of the cases that you were referring to actually involved admissions by broker-dealer firms.
Well, so the Convergex case clearly did. There was improper markups, undisclosed markups, and the conduct was egregious, went over the course of a number of years. So that was, you know, pretty heartland broker-dealer conduct. The other case is Scottrade, also a broker-dealer. That involved blue sheets, sort of the failure to produce blue sheet information over the course of 6 years that was problematic for us, and that impacted our ability to investigate the cases. So that was another case. And one thing just to emphasize is, and I think Scottrade sends this message, is that we're not just talking about Sandra-based violations. We're talking about controls violations, too, in the right sort of circumstance. And I think that's important because, you know, I think firms should understand that it's not just Sandra-based violations. And then we have gotten admissions from a couple of other banks, though not necessarily in there. I mean, the Credit Suisse was the failure to register as a broker-dealer, so it was broker-dealer conduct to that extent, although it was their private bank. And then Jack, Bank of America, admitted recently to a case involving disclosures and the like, and that wasn't necessarily broker-dealer conduct. But, right. You know, I think financial institutions, we've had a number, and I think we will in the future have additional ones.
Tim, let me ask, we touched earlier about separating the individual, dealing with the individual separately from the institution. How does that play out in the defense of a client where you've got both vulnerability on the institutional side and on the individual side? How does that impact?
Yeah, so this is an issue I'm sure that's near and dear to most people in the room's heart, the decision as to whether or not you can represent multiple parties in the same investigation. And a couple of years ago, Andrew, your predecessor, Rob Kazami, came out with his lawyers behaving badly speech, where among the things that he said he was surprised to see was that there were some lawyers representing multiple parties in cases where, at least to him, there were clear conflicts between the parties' interests. And that was coupled with the announcement that the SEC was going to adopt or borrow from many of the tools that the Department of Justice has used for many years that would foster cooperation, including things like deferred prosecution agreements, non-prosecution agreements, perhaps even maybe immunity, which sort of suggests that an individual might have a real interest in cooperating if there's to be some leniency or perhaps immunity that might create itself a conflict for a lawyer who's representing that individual and any others, because in the race to the commission, I would think he who gets there first gets the most credit. I'm interested, let me first ask Jack or Eric, have you seen increasing occasions where you have to separate counsel or get different counsel for multiple individuals and as well as the firm?
Go ahead.
Look, I think as a matter of policy, certainly it's the case at Morgan Stanley, you know, if we have any concern at all about an individual's conduct or that an individual may find themselves at a peril different and apart from the firm, that they ought to have their own counsel, that it's in their interest as well. I think everything I've said today, I think that the challenges always become when there's a difference of opinion on that. Is this person just a witness, or has the staff decided that this person is more than a witness? I think and the tension on this issue arises, and it's sort of, I'm sure, what Rob was talking about. It arises when there's a disagreement about that.
Yeah.
And you're often, you know, obviously if you're dealing with the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, you can kind of have that conversation relatively early in the dialogue, and you know, you took your steer from that. Oh, this person's a subject. You know, look, everybody was a subject. But if you heard someone was a witness, you know, you'd be candid. Look, you'd say, okay, well, I can take this person in. And I think that over the years, the U.S. Attorney's Office realized that there was a real benefit in company counsel working with someone as a witness to try and understand the facts, and they would reserve the use of the obvious subject and target, of course, completely different. I think, you know, like everything here, the SEC, as they become more prosecutorial from a law enforcement perspective in their approach, lots of people on the staff are just kind of learning how to interact with counsel on these issues. And I would say my experience over the years has been that the ability to have, and maybe we'll get there, but the ability to have this kind of candid dialogue early on with an assistant U.S. attorney is much easier than with a person, you know, a junior person on the staff at the SEC. Now, maybe you guys are working on that. I hope you are. And look, I'm not spending a lot of time anymore talking with junior people at the SEC. So this is all just getting filtered up from either our outside counsel. But it's just it's a tougher nut to crack early on. Yeah. And so you agree with that?
I agree 100%. And I still spend my time talking to junior people at the SEC. And I'm happy to do that. But I think you raise a good point. I mean, we've always been very conservative, right, in terms of getting separate counsel for an individual, whether it's, I mean, we don't run into the Southern District that often, but even, you know, with the SEC, I mean, but I'd rather get someone separate counsel, right? These are pretty sophisticated people, right? They know they have a right to counsel. They may be suspicious of counsel that represents the firm anyway. They want their own lawyer anyway. So I'd rather do that rather than have them come back, management or a trader or somebody, and say, "Hey, you know, you stuck me with the firm's with the firm's legal counsel, and they weren't giving me independent, you know, advice or whatever." I'd rather do that early on. But on the point in terms of talking to the staff, yeah, I think that's important, and they ought to understand that we do that, and we're willing to listen to them. I've seen situations. I can think of a recent situation where the staff came to me and said, "Hey, we approached this guy. He's no longer employed by you, but he went to counsel that represents you in another matter, you know, with the suspicion that we sent them there so that, you know, the firm would be conflicted or cause them to take a different direction." If they had come to us first, we would have recommended, and we usually do a few different choices for him to go pick from, as opposed to send him to a firm that represents us.
Look, and the last thing I'd say is I think the shame of it is sometimes it's actually counterproductive to what exactly you're trying to, what you guys yeah. are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, let me say this. I mean, I think I hear what you're saying, and I was obviously on the other side for a long time myself, so I certainly had, you know, have similar impressions. But I do think since I've been there, and even before, I think even, you know, Rob and George have encouraged people to be more frank upfront with people about how they perceive witnesses and how they fit into the bigger picture. We don't have subject, target, witness designations. That's comes with a lot of baggage. But I have encouraged people to be more upfront about whether somebody's the focus of the investigation, whether we have concerns about their conduct. I think that's, for various reasons, critical. I mean, I've also been emphasizing because we would like to have witnesses when we get to trial. And the way to get witnesses often is to give people some comfort that you're not necessarily Absolutely. Targeting them. And the lower level people, giving them that that comfort earlier on, or fitting them into the cooperation program, which, you know, you paired with this topic, which is, you know, there is obviously some connection, I think is important. And so we've been emphasizing, I hope you've seen us get better on that. I hope we'll get better in the future on that, because I do think that there's a lot to be benefited from doing that kind of upfront.
Great. Well, in the time remaining, I thought we might turn to some of the newer kinds of enforcement proceedings, substantive violations that people might not have even thought about 10 or even 5 years ago. And I'm speaking about this burgeoning and somewhat confusing electronic trading environment that we are now in. Andrew, could you start this off by telling us a bit about how the Enforcement Division is approaching these new kinds of trading abuses, algorithmic trading, automated trading, high-frequency trading? What has happened and what kinds of guidance might you give people about what could be happening in the future?
Sure. Obviously, it's a high priority area for us. I call them broadly market structure type cases, which are, you know, cases arising out of trading type issues. And, you know, I think that there's a tendency to think about this area maybe in terms, because the press has been very focused on high frequency trading only, but I actually like to step back and remind people that this area is much broader than that, and that our focus needs to be broader than that to really enforce the law correctly in this area. So, you know, I start with there are really, from my perspective, four different focuses in this area. You know, exchanges, ATSs, broker-dealers, and then traders. And when you think of it that way, you sort of look at our enforcement program in this area and you realize that we are very focused on each of those. So, you know, exchanges, we brought, you know, against every major exchange a case in the last 3 years. In fact, until 3 years ago, we had not had a penalty against an exchange. And the last 3 years, we've had, I think, 6 cases, over $25 million in penalties, and more to come. And so, you know, I think, and you see different types of cases in here, not having appropriate rules, not following rules, not having appropriate regulatory controls, and various other issues, controls issues. And so, you know, that's an important area. ATSs is a sort of a burgeoning area as trading moves towards ATSs more. The market becomes, ATSs become more important in trading. We've been very much focused there. The kinds of violations we're finding there include use of confidential information improperly in violation of the rules, or failure to disclose on form ATS what you're actually doing, so failure to conform to how you're actually disclosing that your business is working. We brought a number of cases in this area, the Lava Flow case, which involved using confidential information, smart order router that an affiliate had, the LiquidNet case involving using confidential trading information and marketing purposes. And there will be more of these sorts of cases in these areas, as well as in some other violations. And I think what you're seeing here is as trading migrates to this area, we're seeing abuses in this area as well. And then broker-dealers, you know, the key issues here include, but not limited to, the market access rules of 15C3-5, which requires you to have policies and procedures reasonably designed to guard against both financial and regulatory risks. And we brought in last year the two first cases under each of those prongs. So the Knight Capital case was under the financial risks, and it was a case that we brought relating to trading that was where controls just failed. And we can talk about that some more if you'd like. And then the Wedbush case that we brought out in San Francisco, which involved regulatory control, so the failure to pre-approve traders and then to ensure that they're following the law. And so that's an important area where you have the broker-dealer's role in connection with this sort of trading coming to prominence and one that we're focused on. And then finally, obviously, there are the traders, and there are manipulative trading strategies that includes high-frequency trading firms, but it's not limited to high-frequency trading firms. Those are challenging cases because there is vast amounts of trading. There are challenges in showing manipulative intent. and so they're complicated cases, but we do have a number of investigations relating to high-frequency trading firms. I expect we may well see cases, but we have had cases involving manipulative trading conduct in the past few years. So, you know, most of them involve layering conduct, which involves the use of non-bonafide orders that the trader intends to cancel before they're executed to induce other people to buy and sell securities at prices that don't represent actual supply and demand. And we've had a number of these layering cases, including one in April of this year against a trader. Baramus is another one, the Hull Brothers case. So we've had a number of these cases involving layering. And, you know, we're still seeing that conduct out there. And, you know, so manipulative trading strategies is clearly a focus of ours as well.
It seems that there are two challenges for lawyers. One is this is so densely technological, and we're not trained as lawyers to understand technology in that depth. So the skills that lawyers need to bring to bear is to ask the right questions of those who are in charge of technology and in charge of trading. The other challenge is that these are setting, you know, new precedents. There's not a lot of case law to guide practitioners. Can you help the private practitioners that are here today by sharing how you deal with those issues within the SEC, heavily populated by lawyers? How do you get your arms around the technology and the programming that comes with this trading?
No question. These are incredibly complicated areas. A couple of things on this. First, I think an important thing for us in the enforcement division has been the creation of expertise, particularly in the units, but also in other parts of the division. It allows really for people to become very experienced in this area. So the market abuse unit, very focused on these areas, has developed tremendous expertise. And what they do is they have a couple of sources that help them with this, because as you said, they're lawyers. They're not, they haven't worked on the street for the most part and the like. So two sources that we've really drawn upon and used. One is industry experts. We have in the market abuse unit a number of industry experts that come to us from the industry, as well as some of the other units, and well as OC. And we draw upon that and that knowledge, and that, you know, it's really incredible. I've met with a number of them on many occasions. And, you know, I think you really realize the importance of having in-house folks who know how this works. And then the second thing we do is we draw on the expertise of the other divisions. So trading and markets, I think the relationship between the market abuse folks and trading and markets is really just outstanding. And you know, they have, you know, just an incredible amount of interaction on these cases. As you suggest, they are not necessarily intuitive cases to make. And so they are, we really need to have that sort of expertise, and we've drawn upon it. And you probably see that in our orders. And just to sort of answer the second part of your question, which is the lack of precedent, you know, I think every rule, every statute will have some, you know, will not necessarily be clear ex ante when a violation has occurred, but you have to just interpret the rule. So, if, you know, you take the Knight Capital case, a lot of what you see in the Knight Capital case, you see in the release relating to the market access rule. You see statements in the release which are aimed at getting at the type of conduct that was at issue in the Knight Capital case. Same with the Wedbush case. You go back to the release and you see sort of the origins of our claim that there's a violation. And so I think, you know, we've been careful. You know, obviously there's a lot of there's a view out there, and I agree with this view, that we shouldn't be regulating by enforcement. That's not what we're doing here. What we're doing here is taking facts and applying them to rules that we think are pretty clear and where we think there's a clear violation. We're not going to bring a case when we don't think there's a clear violation.
We are running out of time, but I would turn to Jack or Eric with just a quick note, if either of you have, about how you are dealing with at your respective firms, or one of you, regarding the new generation of enforcement cases that are based on electronic trading. Perhaps Jack.
With respect to electronic trading and the sort of the high tech issues, I think we're turning more and more to non-lawyers, right, who have expertise in those areas.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We are coming to the end of our discussion. Tim, Andrew, Eric, and Jack, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and insights. I hope that all Our audience found this to be an informative discussion on current issues in broker-dealer enforcement. Today's program will add to the valuable body of language, of knowledge, I should say, in the Bingham Presents series. The audio of the broadcast will be available soon in the virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, and an edited transcript will be added later. Bingham's website will also have a transcript of today's discussion. So, on behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Bingham McCutcheon again for their sponsorship and hospitality in making today's program possible. Thanks also to our audiences, both gathered here in New York and listening online. Good evening.